What if you had a data set that could show you which companies did well and not so well when it comes to discrimination and hiring? And what if you named those companies?
So this might be valuable for job seekers who are out there, you know, thinking about their options and weighing which types of jobs to apply to. Maybe knowing that about the existence of experimental evidence might help them make more informed choices. We think it might be useful for regulators who, again, are thinking about whether or not they can be more strategic about how they prioritize their enforcement activities.
Welcome to The Pie. I'm your host, Tess Vigeland. Economists are always talking about the pie, how it grows and shrinks, how it's sliced, who gets the biggest share. In this show, we're talking about the most pressing matters of the day seen through the lens of economics. The Pie is a production of the University of Chicago's Becker Friedman Institute. And in this episode, we're hearing about new research that puts names to companies and industries that have discriminatory proclivities in their hiring practices. This is a follow-up to previous research that sent out some 80,000 resumes to 10,000 different jobs. The aim was to see how hiring decisions were made based on fake resumes that featured identical qualifications, but different names that were suggestive of race and gender. Today, we hear why it's important for those corporate decisions to have a face.
My name is Evan Rose. I'm the Neubauer Family Assistant Professor in the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago.
So, Evan, I'd like to start with a review of an experiment that you conducted a couple of years ago where you sent out resumes to Fortune 500 companies. Remind us what that experiment was measuring and your findings, and then we'll get to what you've now gone back and done with that data.
Our experiment was a correspondence study, which is a very popular method that's used in economics as well as the broader social sciences for measuring discrimination on the basis of race and gender in the labor market. And it's a methodology that was actually popularized by two other UChicago economists, Marianne Bertrand and Sandelmull Nathan, in an important paper from 2004. And the idea here is that what researchers do is send fictional resumes, so fake applications to jobs, where those resumes are balanced or equal, so there's no differences in the characteristics you see across those resumes, except for the fact that the resumes vary in a signal of race or gender identity. So think about two equivalent resumes, but one might have Jamal as the first name of the job applicant and one might have Greg. And you send many of those resumes to many job postings, you measure what comes back, whether or not the employers contact you for a job interview. And if employers are less likely to contact Jamal's resume relative to Greg's, you know it's not because there was something else on the resume, like Jamal had, you know, worse prior employment history or maybe less formal education. You know, actually, the resumes were equivalent, so it has to be because the employer is just learning something about the name. And what we assume is that the employer is actually learning that Jamal is likely to be a Black applicant and Greg is more likely to be a white applicant, and therefore that's informative of race discrimination. And the same idea applies for gender, if we're thinking about, you know, Greg relative to Emily. So this is an incredibly popular methodology. There's literally dozens and dozens and dozens of studies doing this around the world and trying to measure how the types of penalties that somebody like named Jamal or somebody named Emily might face in the labor market. Almost all of those studies, though, measure the type of discrimination that you would expect at a random job or the average job. So you might go to an online job board and you might just pull down jobs randomly and apply to them, you know, over the course of your study. And that's important because it tells us about the average level of discrimination you can measure in these types of methods. But what it doesn't tell you about is anything about the distribution of discrimination, either across jobs or firms. And that distribution is important for economic theory. There's a lot of economic theory that thinks about how the distribution of discrimination across employers might translate or not into the equilibrium wage gaps that you see across groups. Of course, it's also important from a more practical perspective in terms of enforcement. If somebody like the EEOC is interested in trying to reduce the level of discrimination in the labor market, if it's concentrated in some sectors or some firms or some geographies, then maybe concentrated action in those areas can have a big impact. So what we did in our study was not change the methodology. We're still sending fictional resumes to firms, but we changed this the way we sampled those jobs and those firms in our study. We essentially took the Fortune 500 and we identified about 100 firms where we thought we could send many, many job applicants to the same firms over the course of our entire study, and we did that. So we sent up to 1,000 job applications to up to 100 jobs at each of about 100 of these companies. So it's almost like we had an experiment of the same magnitude, roughly, as has been done in the past, like in Sandel and Marianne's work from 2004. But we did that 100 times at 100 different companies. And so what?
And it was much more targeted.
It was targeted, right, at these Fortune 500 companies. So, of course, we can look at the average level of discrimination we saw. Was the Jamal in our study less likely to get called back than the Greg? But more importantly, we can characterize where that's coming from. So were there differences across these Fortune 500 companies in the penalty that Jamal faced relative to Greg? And which of these companies seem to have the largest penalties for applicants named Jamal relative to Greg? And likewise, when we think about gender for the Emilys versus the Gregs.
And so the primary findings from that initial experiment.
So what we found was that there continues to be an important level of discrimination against distinctively Black names in the labor market on average. I should mention, by the way, that all the jobs we applied to in the experiment, you should think about entry-level jobs at these Fortune 500 companies. We'll get into some examples of these companies later. But think about jobs that don't require a lot of experience or advanced degrees, so sales jobs or entry-level manufacturing jobs, basic kind of employment. So what we found was that applying to those jobs with a distinctively Black name comes at a penalty. It's about a 10% penalty. We found no average penalty for applying to those jobs with a distinctively female name, but those means masked a ton of heterogeneity. So for race, what we found is that actually firms seem to differ quite a bit in the extent of discrimination on the basis of race. Some firms seem to exhibit very little discrimination, meaning that they're just as likely to call back the Jamal relative to the Greg on average across all the jobs we sampled. Some firms seem to have much larger penalties. For gender, we found that many firms seem to have zero average gap, meaning they were no more or less likely to call back Emilys versus Gregs. Some firms seem to exhibit strong preference for calling back Gregs. So you think about that as discrimination against women or in favor of men. And some firms seem to exhibit strong preferences for calling back women, discrimination in favor of the Emilys relative to Gregs. So firms differ a lot. And not only that, it seems like a relatively small share of firms account for a lot of the discrimination we measured. So we do some exercises in the paper that show that maybe about 20% of firms, so the top quintile of firms, so 20 out of these 100 firms that we studied, explain about half of the total discrimination that we measure on the basis of race and gender. So the findings were really that there's average discrimination, yes, just like many other studies have shown in the past, but there's a ton of heterogeneity across firms in the extent to which they exhibit discrimination when measured this way with these correspondence studies. And that discrimination is quite concentrated in a tail of employers who seem to discriminate more than others.
Okay, so the experiment basically found gaps in responses by companies to white versus Black applicants. And now you've used those gaps to grade specific companies and industries here. Walk us through what you were looking for, how you went about ranking these companies and industries. What were the actual grades and how did you determine them?
Okay, great. Yeah, this is super important. Thanks. So although we had a lot of data about every firm in our study, as we were discussing earlier, there's still quite substantial statistical uncertainty about the level of discrimination that we measured at each of these firms. And when we set about the task of communicating the results of our experiment to the public, in particular naming the names of the firms in our study, we wanted to devise a simple way to release this information where people could clearly interpret differences across firms and not overinterpret small differences in the noisy estimates that we collected. Okay, so if you just release the raw data, for example, there's going to be differences in contact rates, which really aren't informative about which firms are discriminating more than others. It just happens to be due to the sampling uncertainty, the statistical uncertainty in our experiment. So what this paper really does, and this is a key part of the academic contribution, is devise a procedure where instead of just releasing the raw estimates, you can release the estimates. Of course, you can always do that. But you can also assign firms into categories or grades where we can provide certain statistical guarantees about how likely it is that the firms in the worst grades, indicating the most discrimination, are actually discriminating more than the firms in other grades and grades indicating less discrimination. And the key here is that the grades are groupings of firms. So some firms might share a grade, which is our experiment's way and our methodology's way of telling you that, look, these are firms which kind of had pretty similar levels of discrimination in the study, can't really be too confident that one's discriminating more than the other. But of course, there's multiple grades. So some firms are going to get a different grade. And those are the comparisons we want you to focus on. Just how if you were grading your students in your class, for example, there might be a couple of students whose performance is roughly at the A level. They all get an A, and that's a better grade than getting a B, which indicates less comprehension of the course material. But within the A's and B's, you're not trying to make these fine distinctions. And that coarsening allows us to really ramp up how reliable these procedures are. In fact, these grades are. In fact, in our baseline grading procedure, we think that in expectation, you should only get about 5% of the comparisons across firms in different grades wrong, right? So, you know, of the several thousand potential comparisons you might make based on our study, you're only going to get a couple hundred incorrect. And we think that's massively powerful because it allows you to communicate what we learned from our study in a very low dimensional setting. These are just three grades, but also providing better guarantees about how reliable that information is.
Okay, so just to be very clear, you decided to use stars.
Yeah, so we decided to use stars. We could have used letter grades too. And for race discrimination, what we do is we grade firms on the basis of the extent to which they discriminated against Black applicants, but the distinctive Black names in our experiment. We're doing that because there's the evidence in our data is consistent with no firm showing a preference on average for calling back distinctively Black names, meaning discrimination against white applicants. So we end up with a grading scheme where the worst grade, which we'll call one star, indicates the most discrimination against Black applicants. The best grade, which in our baseline scheme ends up being a three-grade scheme, or so the best grade is a three-star, that ends up indicating the least discrimination against the distinctive Black names in our experiment.
Okay. Let's get to a couple of specific examples here. What is a company that was less discriminatory toward Black applicants? What does that look like? So that this would be a three-star.
Sure. So in our baseline estimates, where we just use the simplest model to try to analyze the statistical problem I mentioned earlier in constructor grades, we get a handful of firms who get a three-star grade. That includes firms like Target, FedEx, Lowe's, Kohl's, Hilton Hotels, Waste Management, Kroger, Avis Budget, and others. All right. And these are firms where, according to our methodology, it's highly likely that they're discriminating less than the firms that get either a one or two star grade, so which indicates more discrimination. You know, we combine the grades with not only which are designed to make ordinal comparisons, so thinking about which firms discriminate more than others, with information about the level of discrimination. And the firms that are in this three star grade have best guesses of the level of discrimination, a term we call a posterior mean, which is just what we think is the sort of a noise-adjusted estimate for how much discrimination is actually happening here on the average of, you know, only about 2 or 3%. So these are firms that we think seem to discriminate less than the other firms in our study, and the level of discrimination that we measured there is mild compared to other firms.
Then how about one or two of the worst firms?
Yeah, so some firms in our study exhibited quite large contact penalties, meaning differences in the contact rates for Jamal's versus Greg's. Firms with some of the largest contact penalties in our study ended up in the one-star grade, which is our grade indicating the most discrimination against Black applicants. That included Genuine Parts, which owns Napa Auto Parts, and AutoNation, which is a large network of car dealerships. And those firms in our baseline procedure end up receiving this grade indicating single star, meaning that they're in the category where we can be most confident that they're discriminating more than the other firms in our study.
So as you've been talking about, in addition to discrimination by race, you also looked at gender, and this is from the same data set. So can you give us an idea of companies that did well and not so well in discrimination against not just women, but I find this fascinating. You looked at discrimination against men.
That's right. Yeah. So I think the way to characterize what we learned about gender is that most firms seem to exhibit either mild or zero discrimination either way. So some of the firms I mentioned earlier end up in a middle grade, an intermediate grade, which indicates not a lot of discrimination in either direction. Firms like Dollar Tree, Macy's, Geico, Dollar General, AT&T, Best Buy, Olive Garden, a whole host of firms didn't show us much evidence in either direction. Then there's some firms where the evidence seemed to suggest that they're discriminating more excessively against women. That firm that actually exhibited the largest contact penalty against women in our study is Builders FirstSource, which is a large supplier of building materials and distributor of building materials. They had a contact penalty, which once we've adjusted for statistical uncertainty, is on the order of about 100%, meaning they're just much, much more likely to contact applications. We sent fictional applications. We sent them with distinctively male names relative to distinctively female names. There are a set of firms, so that leads our procedure to put builders into its own grade at the very top, indicating the most discrimination against women. There's another set of firms which indicated some discrimination, showed some discrimination against women in the experiment, perhaps not as extreme as builders. That includes LKQ Auto, which is another auto firm which supplies in wholesale capacity, specialty auto parts, JP Morgan Chase, and Honeywell, manufacturer of a lot of appliances and other things. So they had contact, they exhibited average discrimination against women in our study on the order of maybe 20% or so once we adjust for noise. There's also a set of firms at the other end of the stream that seem to be discriminating against men. The firm with the largest contact penalty against men in our study is the Ascena Group, which owns a major retail brands you've probably heard of, like Ann Taylor Loft. A couple other firms also end up sharing the same bottom grade with Ann Taylor, including another apparel company like VFC Corp, which owns the North Face and Vans. So the gender picture really sort of captures the two-sided nature of the discrimination, where maybe the modal firm in our experiment didn't show much evidence either way, but then there was these extremes of firms that seem to exhibit a lot of discrimination either against men or against women.
Are gender and race correlated at all here? Did you see the same results by company and or industry with gender and race?
Not very. So, and this is something we analyzed in our previous paper as well. It doesn't look like the firms that discriminate most on the basis of race are also the firms that in our experiment were discriminating most on the basis of gender. In both race and gender, we measure firm-level discrimination. And then one thing we detected was a lot of industry clustering. So there's strong industry patterns to what we measure here. For gender, you can probably sort of guess what the industries were and which industries the firms that discriminate most.
Right. When you mentioned automotive parts and construction, I was like, well, okay. Yeah. Not a surprise there.
Right. And so this was something that we measured in our previous paper too. And I think it's even more clear when you see the names of the firms that are actually in our study. So kind of heavy manufacturing, you tend to see more discrimination against women. And in apparel, in particular female apparel, you see more discrimination against men. And something we even do in our paper is grade the industry level discrimination, aggregating the firms up into two-digit SIC codes and then asking, can we be confident? What grades would we give each industry overall? For gender, for example, our procedure really singles out the apparel stores industry as somewhere where you should expect to see a lot of discrimination against men overall. And for race, we see industry clustering too, but not as easily explainable, instead of not as intuitive or maybe concordant with stereotypes you might have about which types of jobs are gendered. For race, what really seems to be happening is we see a lot of discrimination against Black applicants in the auto parts and services, in particular retail auto parts and services. So think about firms like AutoNation, which I mentioned earlier, which is actually selling cars, or Napa Auto Parts, which is selling car parts in retail, Advance Auto Parts, CarMax. These kind of companies all seem to exhibit actually some of the largest and most precise contact penalties for Black applicants in our experiment. And so there are strong industry patterns for race as well, but quite different from what we measure for gender. And the net result of all of that is that it doesn't look like there's a very strong correlation on race and gender discrimination in what we measured.
You also identify these companies by which ones are federal contractors and therefore subjected supposedly to higher scrutiny of their hiring practices. What did you find there?
Yeah, so I want to just be clear about one thing very quickly, which is that our assessment in this paper is we are not making a legal assessment about the extent to which any of these firms might have violated anti-discrimination law. When we use the term discrimination, we're using that because that is the scientific term that's used in this literature to describe what happens when there are fewer contacts for distinctively Black or distinctively female names. So every time I say discrimination, that's what I'm talking about. And this is not, our evidence alone would not be the basis for any kind of legal action against these firms. We still think this would be useful for regulators, though, in thinking about, where they might expect to see more discrimination, where they could direct other enforcement action. And two bodies that are charged with enforcing discrimination laws in the U.S., of course, are the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission, the EEOC, and the OFCCP, which audits compliance of federal contractors with hiring laws. And so if you are a federal contractor, you are subject to oversight by the OFCCP, who has the authority to audit your hiring practices at any given time. And what we found actually in our previous paper was that firms that have more contact with the government overall, including being a federal contractor, having previous run-ins with the Department of Labor through wage and hour violations or even previous suits by the EEOC seem to discriminate less on average. But of course, that's just what happens on average. There are many firms who end up in top grades in our study and who exhibited large contact penalties, either on the basis of race and gender, who are indeed federal contractors. So this just illustrates how we think that this methodology is useful and potentially could be built into, you know, prospective enforcement ideas that people like the regulators at the EEOC and OFCCP could be using in order to think about how to more strategically target enforcement action in the future. I mean, in general, I think there's kind of two ways to think about enforcement of anti-discrimination law. One, you might think of as bottom up, where what you do is you wait for individual litigants to bring complaints and say, hey, you know, I was working at this firm, I experienced discrimination, I'd like to raise a complaint, file a complaint, and then, you know, the EEOC can pursue that and move forward. The other way to approach anti-discrimination format might be to take a more top-down approach. We try to identify what we call systemic patterns that either exist at the industry or firm level, and then think about whether or not there's policies or practices that are common across firms in that industry or across a single firm that might, you know, exacerbate the type of discrimination we measure in our study. A lot of discrimination enforcement right now in the U.S. is very much bottom-up. The EEOC primarily deals with individual litigants. I think our paper demonstrates that you can identify these systemic patterns across firms within firms and discrimination using scientific methods, and that you can reliably identify which firms are maybe worthy of further scrutiny and investigation on the basis of this kind of experimental evidence.
Evan, why name the companies? And did you receive any blowback from them? What's the reaction been?
We haven't received much blowback yet because we've only just done it. These kind of studies are sometimes controversial because people worry about the use of deception in sending these fictional applications to firms. They also worry about the potential cost to firms. I think those are really important considerations. In my view, like in many social science questions, you got to weigh the cost benefits here. I view the cost as relatively small to these firms of having been subjected to our experiment, and I view the benefits as large, in that we really don't seem to know very much about the distribution of discrimination in the economy and what potentially drives it. Okay, so this experiment has made huge progress on that question, I think, and there's value there. Now, why name the names itself as opposed to just sticking with the anonymized version? Well, we think there's value in following up and thinking more closely about what's happening at these specific firms. So this might be valuable for job seekers who are out there, you know, thinking about their options and weighing which types of jobs to apply to, and maybe knowing that about the existence of experimental evidence might help them make more informed choices. We think it might be useful for regulators who, again, are thinking about whether or not they can be more strategic about how they prioritize their enforcement activities. We also think it might be useful for the academics themselves, like us, who want to understand, well, what drives the actual patterns that we see here. This opens the door by publishing these names for people to write follow-up studies and, you know, maybe dig into genuine parts specifically, for example, and understand at the micro level, how did they structure hiring? How did they make decisions? How do kind of HR policies do they have? And can we think about the fact that, you know, genuine parts ended up exhibiting more discrimination against the fictional applications in our study as being driven by any of those policies and practices? You know, and if we weren't able to name the names of the firms, then we wouldn't be able to take that next step and, you know, take this research to the next level and think about prospectively what we could change from a policy and practice perspective that would help eliminate some of the problematic discrimination that we measured.
I know you are a researcher, but if you could wave a magic wand and change policy based on what you found here, have you thought about what that might be?
Yeah, so this is something that I think we spent a lot of time figuring out in both in the previous paper and in this paper. And it's hard because we don't have a lot of information about what's happening inside these firms. It's kind of a black box. You know, we send these fictional resumes, we find out whether or not the employer calls us back over the next couple of weeks, but we don't really know how they're processed. That said, we were able to analyze some indirect evidence that I think gives some interesting clues about what's happening here. And one thing we did was try to understand how centralized the HR process is at each of these firms. So one thing we can measure is for every firm we applied to jobs for, we can measure how many unique phone numbers seem to be calling us back from that firm. At firms where that number is really big, presumably that means that a lot of different individuals are involved in hiring because, you know, maybe the person who just happens to be the manager on duty on a Friday night is reviewing applications. Maybe the next night it's a different person. Some firms, that number is smaller because it seems like one or two people are maybe in charge of hiring at a couple different establishments at the firm. And what we found is there was a quite strong correlation between how centralized the hiring process is and how much discrimination we saw, and that firms that have more centralized hiring seem to exhibit less discrimination. So I think a natural hypothesis is that one thing that happens across firms is there's different degrees of professionalization in the HR process, how much training and oversight the people actually making hiring decisions do, and also how much time they're investing in making these decisions. Is this something that you're doing like in 10 seconds per application to try to get through the stack as fast as you can, or you're actually sort of sitting down and trying to evaluate carefully the qualifications of the people who apply to your job? Potentially at firms where things are less centralized, there's less training, and decisions are happening faster, that's exactly the kind of situation where the maybe implicit bias creeps in, and whether somebody's aware of it or not, might be less likely to, you know, highlight a name that they associate with some negative characteristics. So one that's, again, just all totally indirect evidence. It's just a correlation that we saw in our last data, but I think it, in our last experiment, but I think it suggests that there are practical things to be done about oversight in the hiring process and how you manage the hiring process, which might help mitigate the potential for the type of discrimination that we measure here.
Evan Rose, absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much. This was a lot of fun.
The Pie is a production of the Becker Friedman Institute for Economics and part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network. If you'd like to keep in touch with the latest economic research from the University of Chicago, you can visit bfi.uchicago.edu/subscribe. If you're enjoying the discussions we're having on this show, there's another University of Chicago Podcast Network show that you should check out. It's called Big Brains. Big Brains brings you the stories behind the pivotal scientific breakthroughs and research that are shaping our world. Change how you see the world and keep up with the latest academic thinking with Big Brains, part of the University of Chicago Podcast Network. Our theme music was composed by Story Mechanics, production assistants from the BFI Communications team. I'm Tess Vigeland, your host and executive producer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.